Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Mati Friedman, whose book is titled Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story. Mati Friedman is the author of an earlier book, The Aleppo Codex, In Pursuit of One of the World's Most Coveted, Sacred, and Mysterious Books. Has written for The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, writes for Tablet currently, former AP correspondent, has written for The Atlantic a couple of recent articles that were pretty controversial. Mati Friedman lives in Jerusalem, but grew up for 17 years in Toronto, which actually plays a role in Pumpkin Flowers. Pumpkin Flowers is a pillbox, I guess, in southern Lebanon that was occupied by Israeli soldiers for a few years back in the 90s. And this book is about that and about that war in southern Lebanon, which is pretty much forgotten today. You were an Israeli soldier for a brief period, correct?
That's right. I served in the army from 1997 to 2000.
So you'd written Aleppo Codex and you'd been a correspondent. What prompted you to go back and try to recapture not only the story of a now forgotten bit of history, but your own life as an Israeli soldier?
My first attempt to write about my experiences in the army actually predated my career as a journalist and predated the publication of the Aleppo Codex, which was my first book. I was discharged in the spring of 2000, around the same time that this strange little war in South Lebanon came to an end, and I tried to write about it not long afterward. And my attempts to write about it were, let's just say they were unripe, not particularly successful, and I put them aside and went on to be a journalist and worked in a number of different places, published a book. Over the years that elapsed between that first attempt to write about it and the present, I watched these wars unfold in the Middle East, the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I saw the unraveling of the Middle East over the past couple of years, and I realized that my experiences in South Lebanon had not just been important to me, which is what I understood in 2000, 2001, 2002 when I was writing about it the first time, but that they'd been important for an understanding of the Middle East and the world in 2016. I think that the little war we saw in South Lebanon ended up being, in many ways, the first war of the 21st century, and that makes understanding it useful to anyone who's trying to wrap their heads around the world of today.
When you decided to go back to it, did you have already written materials? Had you already done some research?
I had a manuscript that I had written early on, 12 years or so before I made this renewed attempt to write about it. The manuscript itself isn't great, but it includes a lot of raw material that was very valuable because it was written so quickly after my army service. Many of the incidents were still fresh in my mind, and there were many details in that early manuscript that I could then mine for this renewed attempt to write about it. So it ended up being quite useful. That's what I had even before I began doing research in the archives and began trying to track down other guys who had been on the same hill throughout the 1990s.
The book is divided into four sections. I assume the final section didn't really happen until you were working on the book, correct?
The final section recounts a visit that I took back to this hill in Lebanon, not as a soldier this time, but as a Canadian tourist. I did this a few years after I'd been there as a soldier. That was always in my mind part of this story, and it was an idea that I had fairly early. The nucleus of the idea, I think, was present even when I was a soldier on the hill, that one day I would be able to get back there and see this place, not through a gun sight, but just as a civilian. And that was a dream that I had, and over the years, the two or so years that elapsed between my discharge and my return to Lebanon as a civilian, the idea wouldn't really let me go. So I ended up doing it, and I did that in the fall of 2002 as I made that first attempt to write about these experiences. So it was always part of the story. I always envisioned it as opening with a military experience on this hill and ending with a civilian experience in the same place, seeing the same place through a different set of eyes.
Well, what happened that threw you off it? What was wrong about that early manuscript then?
If you read about the writers who wrote about the First World War, guys like Siegfried Sassoon and Edmund Blunden, you'll find that a lot of these guys published their memorable works about that war about a decade after the war ended. And some of them, Edmund Blunden is a good example. Blunden writes in his book Undertones of War, he writes in the introduction that he came back from the war and immediately began to write about it, and it was terrible. And he had to put it aside and went back to it years later. Many memorable works about wars end up being published a decade or more after the end of the war. I think there's something about that kind of experience, perhaps because it's so intense and so incomprehensible while it's going on, that requires time to settle before anything really worthwhile can be written about it. So what I had early on was a very self-centered look at my own experiences without any real ability to see why they would be of interest to anyone else. 15 years later, when I went back to it, the significance of the Lebanon experience had become more clear to me. I had perspective on the period, and I was, I hope, a more mature person and a better writer.
When you went back to it, the opening section with a man named Avi was not there, correct?
That's new.
There's a guy named Avi who is a writer who does not survive and wrote letters to his girlfriend, which you managed to get. How did you find him, and how did you find those letters?
I felt so lucky to find Avi. His full name is Avi Ofnau. He was a soldier on the same hill at this outpost several years before I got there. So he served there from 1994 to 1997, and 1997 was the year that I was drafted. I was doing interviews for the book, and I was sitting in archives, and I was looking for other soldiers who had served at the same place. There was a chat room online for veterans of the Lebanon war, and through some people in that chat room, I got a cell phone number that led to another cell phone number, and I managed to make connections, and I drove around the country finding guys who had been there, you know, people who were now farmers, or one guy was a physicist, and there was a cop and a psychiatrist and people doing all kinds of different things, but who shared this experience. I also found parents of soldiers who had died at the outpost, and I interviewed quite a few of them. I met Avi's parents during this attempt to kind of gather information, and I understood that Avi had written letters and short stories at the outpost, which was very rare. Almost no one wrote at the outpost. We were just too young. Our intellects were unformed. We didn't understand that what we were seeing was important, and none of us had the energy to really lift up our head beyond the exhaustion and kind of, you know, deep depression of military service and write anything worthwhile. And Avi was different. He wrote about it. And his parents were kind enough to give me his letters, give me everything he'd written. And much of it appears in the book. He was a phenomenal writer. And had he survived, he would have been something truly great. Unfortunately, what we have is just the beginning of kind of flexing of his literary muscles, which was cut off too early.
So once you had that, you said, aha, now I got the book.
Avi was the missing piece. I understood, and I've always understood, that I'm not that important. I just saw things that were interesting. But the book couldn't be just a memoir. I never saw it as a memoir. I wanted to convey my experiences as a way of explaining something that I think is important. But it needed to be bigger than me. And I think the addition of Avi, who takes up the first third of the book, makes it bigger than me, and that's as it should be.
Monty Friedman, the element of the book that caught my eye immediately is your ability to remove politics from the war story. Was that easy or hard for you?
The Israel story is such a political minefield, and it's a subject of such hysterical argument on both sides that I needed to be very meticulous in providing an accurate story of this highly charged war without becoming trapped in the contemporary politics of this story and becoming part of this kind of endless screaming match about Israel that I find unbearable on both sides of it. So I talk about the politics of the time. I try to explain what the different players were thinking. But this is a story about soldiers, low-ranking soldiers. It doesn't take you to the rooms where decisions were being made. I never mentioned the prime minister, anyone over the rank of company commander is basically of no interest to me. And as a soldier, what you understand is very limited, and your life is very complicated, but the complications are not the complications of big geopolitical questions. So I wanted to take people into this outpost and into the lives of very young men who'd been taken from high school, basically, and thrown into this very extreme and very interesting set of circumstances. And I wanted to do that without pressing any of the big political buttons that would have made this book kind of ping pong ball for yet another political argument about Israel.
When Avi comes in, you make mention of the fact that the people with him all kind of volunteered for that. At the time that you were drafted, did you volunteer for the pumpkin as well?
Israeli men are drafted out of high school. That's the way it works. And they serve 3 years. Women serve 2 years, and there are exemptions, but most people serve. In theory, combat service is not something you volunteer for, but in practice, it is. If you really don't want to be a combat soldier, you can get out of it. The units that were posted inside Lebanon to these outposts, outposts like the one where I served, which is called the Pumpkin, and other isolated and quite dangerous outposts inside Lebanon, those units were a cut above the average combat unit, and those units were certainly voluntary. So I never understood that I was volunteering for this particular outpost, and my idea of what the Army had planned for me was extremely hazy early on, but I did volunteer for a unit that was more specialized than a regular infantry battalion, and ultimately that's what led me to the Pumpkin.
Why? Why did you volunteer?
I wanted to do the most meaningful service that I could possibly do. I wanted to be with the best people who I could possibly be with. I understood that my ticket into Israeli society was the military. That if I wanted to be Israeli and I wanted to be a part of the society, not just a foreigner living in Israel, not just some Canadian kid who lived in Israel, then the way to do that was military service and the best military service that I could possibly do. My sense of the risks were unformed. In retrospect, though, I'm grateful for my time in the Army, and I'm grateful for my time at this particular outpost, which was a better education than I could have ever hoped for anywhere else.
Your politics at the time, I mean, the politics of a 17-year-old are fairly unformed, or can be fairly unformed, particularly, I guess, for someone whose family has emigrated to Israel. Were you basically, I don't want to say a right-winger, but is that more or less where you were coming from at the time?
No, not at all. I've always been on the left politically in Israel. Even at the time, there was an election while I was in the Army, and I voted for the Labor Party, which I've done consistently since then. Like most Israelis in the 90s, I thought that the conflict was about to be resolved. Many of us believe that a new Middle East was being created. It's almost hard to imagine that time. But if you look at old newspapers from the 90s, which I've done quite a bit as a researcher in the past couple of years, you see that people were actually talking about new highways that would link Baghdad and Tel Aviv, and we would go to Beirut to, you know, sample the nightlife in Beirut, and the Lebanese would come down the coast to Tel Aviv. And this was what people were imagining, and I thought that's what was happening. I thought that the war in Lebanon was the end of something bad. I thought it was the end of this bad old Middle East that would soon be replaced with a Middle East of trade and compromise and contact between people. I not only hoped that would happen, but I thought that's what was happening, as did most Israelis who voted throughout the 1990s for some kind of compromise with Israel's neighbors. The withdrawal from Lebanon in 2000, in the spring of 2000, was conducted by a government, the Ehud Barak government, which had been elected expressly for the purpose of negotiating not just with the Palestinians, but with the Syrians over a peace agreement. In 2000, in the fall of 2000, everything kind of came crashing down. The Second Intifada started that fall, and the Middle East took a very different turn, as we've seen over the past decade and a half. The following year, the 9/11 attacks in the United States and the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the region has kind of become derailed in a way that I think no one could have imagined in the basically hopeful years of the 1990s, in which this narrative in Pumpkin Flowers plays out.
When I spoke with Amos Oz, he told me something that I didn't know, which is that all through the period, basically going back to 67, both Labor and Likud, no matter who was in power, were busy populating the West Bank with settlements, which, to my mind at least, maybe looking at it from the outside, pretty much said that no compromise at a certain point was going to be possible.
in the 1990s, successive Israeli governments made an attempt to strike an agreement, not just with the Palestinians, but with the Syrians. Of course, a peace agreement was signed with Jordan in 1994. Any peace agreement with the Palestinians would have meant the removal of most or all settlements. That was on the table in the years of the Rabin government. That was on the table in the years of the Barak government. And it was on the table after 2000 in the years of the Olmert government as well. The fact that no peace agreement or no regional reconciliation has proved to be possible is tragic, of course, for those of us in Israel who just like to become part of the Arab world and would like a more normal future. The failure of peace moves, however, has a lot to do with the collapse of the region into violence, the absence of any coherent moderate forces with whom we can deal. I don't think Israel is blameless by any means, and I have a lot to say about the flaws in our current leadership and in our policies, but we are a very small moving piece in a vast region where things are badly wrong. The reason for Israel's predicament has a lot to do with what's going on in the region and our ability to impact the region, our ability to rewrite our own fate in the region, whether politically or militarily, is very, very limited. I think that often people in the West don't realize how small Israel is, or what a small piece of the region Israel is. Israel is 0.2% of the landmass of the Arab world, one-fifth of 1%. There are 6 million Jews in Israel. The population of the Arab world is 320 million. So we can be smart and we can be stupid, and I think we're both. But in any case, our moves are going to have limited impact.
I don't want to get too far afield here, but when we look at the growing second-class citizenship and we see Israel falling into an almost South African apartheid world, it becomes even harder for anybody to find a way out. And I suspect that a lot of the anger toward Israel has to do with the fact that, at least at that end, there doesn't seem to be much movement other than making it worse. I mean, we have images of people on a hillside enjoying the bombardment of Gaza.
As an American, if you're looking for, you know, moral problems or stories of inequality or, you know, military action that has vast cost to civilians, I don't think Americans need to look that far afield. You know, I think Americans have a lot to think about in terms of their own society and their own military and its actions in the Middle East over the past decade and a half. And I think a lot of this kind of negative interest in Israel is driven by almost an unwillingness on the part of Americans to think about themselves deeply, and instead a tendency to project certain problems outward onto a blank screen that is Israel. The Israeli predicament is very, very complicated, and if you want to understand the situation in the West Bank, then you have to understand 100 years of Israel's history in the region. You have to understand a vast region in which there are dozens of moving parts. There are the Iranians and the Saudis and the Kurds and ISIS and the Americans and the Russians, and there's also Jabhat al-Nusra, and there is Assad, and there's Hamas, and there's Islamic Jihad, and there's the Palestinian Authority, and there's Fatah, and there are many, many things that one needs to understand in order to understand Israel's very unique set of circumstances. So I do not think by any means that Israel's situation can be boiled down to an easy moral criticism, almost an epithet like apartheid. I think that's a real injustice to the complexities of Israel's situation.
I think a lot of it actually has to do with the fact that, at least for American Jews, they see that and they go, well, wait a second, now Jews are oppressing Palestinians. This comes after years of seeing Israel being advertised as this great, wonderful state, and then suddenly, whoosh, there's this turnaround. It becomes very difficult for American Jews, I think, to be able to get a grasp on it. And it seems that because we become inured to the idea of black and white, we choose one or the other.
That's the mistake, of course. And I think people understand when they think about America that things are not black or white. And I think that there are many stories that can be told about America, right? Not every story about America needs to be about Ferguson. Not every story about America needs to be about Iraq. You can write a book about Iraq and not talk about Afghanistan. There are many different stories that need to be told about something as complicated as a country. So Pumpkin Flowers is an attempt to tell a story that's not, that hasn't been told, and that I think makes clear large parts of Israel's situation beyond the kind of politically charged cliches of the Israel story as it's usually presented.
I want to get to the last part of the book, when you actually used your Canadian passport to get into Lebanon a few years after you were on the other side of it. It's telling that you pretty much had to hide the fact not only that you were Israeli, obviously, but also the fact that you were Jewish, and that what you saw was total hatred geared toward Israel, which sort of makes it impossible to try to come up with some kind of solution. And yet at the same time, you also were in towns that were being bombarded by your own company. And you sort of understandable why they'd hate you guys.
I think that I went back to Lebanon in 2002 with what might have been a naive hope that I would find something like the Christmas truce, the famous Christmas truce of 1914, which is when British and German soldiers unilaterally or unofficially declared a ceasefire and kind of mingled in no man's land. I thought that by going back, I would come away hopeful about the prospects of some kind of, you know, better future for the region. And I didn't come back hopeful because I saw that the enmities are deep. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily unjustified, as you said. I understand why Israelis, you know, have a hostility toward the Middle East. And I understand why people in Lebanon, you know, have hostile feelings toward Israel. I didn't come away with the idea that, you know, it's just a misunderstanding, and if we could all just sit down and talk things out, everything would be okay, which is a very Western idea, maybe a very Canadian idea of what's going on. And these enmities are deep. There are real differences between people. I don't think that there's a moral judgment there on either side. It's just a statement of a fact of human nature, which is that not getting along is very human.
What's striking was that you were able to actually go back to the war zone, which was no longer a war zone and was peaceful, and eat at a restaurant that you'd seen from a distance and visit a villa that you'd seen from a distance.
That was the dream we had when we were soldiers in South Lebanon. We would go in on convoys, armed convoys, from the Israeli border to this outpost, which is about 5 miles. And as we drove, we would pass this beautiful little restaurant on the banks of the Litani River, basically a few shacks on the riverbank. And every time we passed it, we would look with longing at this bucolic restaurant, just tables set up along the water. And we used to say, yeah, we'll come back here one day. We're going to sit at that restaurant. You know, we're not going to have guns or helmets. We're just going to come back as human beings. And we're going to sit here and watch the river go by. And for most of the guys, that was not a realistic plan. But for me, it was possible. So I did it. I did it as part of my return to Lebanon 2 years after I got out of the army. And I went back to this restaurant as a civilian. I got there in a taxi and I sat at the tables that we used to see from the convoys. And I watched the river go by.
Getting back to the notion of just being a soldier, taking out the politics, there are a couple of things about being at the Pumpkin that are very different than what we might think. We know about the boredom, the fact that you guys watched Starship Troopers all the time. But the other part is that you were in a war zone literally 20 minutes by car from your parents' place. That must have been very strange.
That, I think, makes our situation in Lebanon very different from the situation of an American soldier in a place like Iraq. American soldiers get thrown halfway around the world and to some very foreign place. It's very, very distant from home, and what they're doing must seem very hard to understand. It's hard, I imagine, to explain to yourself how your mission in Iraq is a defense of the United States. I think you can explain it and you can understand it, but it's complicated. For us, it wasn't complicated. From the pumpkin, I could turn around and look south, and over about 5 miles of hostile territory, I would see white houses in Metula, which is the northernmost town inside Israel. I would look north, and I would see Nabatea, which was a Shiite town, which was a Hezbollah stronghold. So I knew that to the north of our outpost were the bad guys, and to the south were our people, and we were standing in between the bad guys and our people, and things kind of made sense to me as a soldier.
There were no women there, and I assume there were no gay people there?
There were no women in the security zone. That was one of the rules of the security zone. Combat units in the Israeli army are all male. The hill, as you can imagine, was a place where about 50 or 60 19, 20-year-old men were stuck for weeks on end. So you can imagine the atmosphere at a place like that. Sometimes a woman's voice would come over the radio because there were women soldiers who manned the radios inside Israel and would broadcast into Lebanon, and you'd hear a woman's voice, and you could hear kind of the collective clenching of male throats across the security zone as we heard a woman's voice for the first time in days or maybe weeks. As for gay people, I'm sure there were. I can't remember anyone who was out of the closet, but there are all kinds of people in the Israeli army. There's draft, right? So you go in out of high school, there are gay soldiers in combat units, there are gay officers in the Israeli army. There were probably gay soldiers at the pumpkin. We were 18 or 19, so I'm not sure to what extent even they were aware of it, but there was certainly not an issue in the Israeli army in the same way that it is in the United States.
Did anybody sneak away to smoke dope?
There was a remarkably wholesome atmosphere on this hill. In retrospect, I took it for granted at the time, but having read a lot about what goes on in different armies, it's quite amazing how square we were. At this fort, there was no drinking. There were very few tattoos. There was no fighting that I remember. I don't remember a single fist fight between soldiers cooped up in a tiny little place for weeks on end, and there was no drug abuse at all, as far as I knew at the time. Many years later, someone told me that one of the medics had a Pringles can with a kind of ingenious double bottom, and in that secret space in the Pringles can were kept contraband substances. But certainly the atmosphere at the outpost was pretty wholesome, all in all.
And you had a TV, and you just kept watching videos of movies.
We had a television, which kind of picked up very fuzzy broadcasts from Israel. Sometimes we had reception, and sometimes we didn't. And we also had grainy VHS cassettes, and we watched these movies again and again until the cassettes basically disintegrated. One of them, as you mentioned, was Starship Troopers, which is quite a cultural document of the 1990s.
Did everybody speak English?
No, not at all. The language of the hill was Hebrew. I mean, Israeli kids do English in high school, so people probably had rudimentary English, but no, we all spoke Hebrew, and that was the language, the exception being the trackers. There were trackers at this outpost, as there were at every outpost in Lebanon, and they were Arab Israelis, mostly Bedouin, and they spoke Arabic, of course.
Were you bringing paperbacks up there every week?
I had a lot of reading material. I don't remember everything that I read. I do remember two books that I did read while at the outpost. One was From Beirut to Jerusalem by Thomas Friedman, which is an attempt to understand better what was going on. And the other book that had no direct political connotation that I can recall was Cold Mountain. I think I just picked it up at my parents' place on my way north to Lebanon and read it up at the pumpkin. I still remember reading that book in Lebanon.
Turns out Avi read an author who was pretty much now forgotten named Romain Gary, a French author who I guess in the 50s, I think, was very famous. By the time I was in college and beyond, nobody even read him then.
Romain Gary is a very interesting character. He's been largely forgotten for a while, as you said. He was quite famous even in English. He lived in America for a time, and he was a larger-than-life literary character. I think they don't make them like that anymore. In Israel, he remains very famous. So he wrote a book at the end of his life, which is called The Kites.
Was he Jewish, by the way?
Romain Gary was Jewish.
Okay.
He was born in Eastern Europe and ended up in France and became a pilot in the Free French Air Force. He was a hero of the Free French Air Force in the 1940s and then became a great literary figure in France. He wrote a book called The Kites, and that was translated into Hebrew and is now in, I think, its 35th printing in Hebrew. It's an incredibly popular book in Israel, still widely read. That book has not been translated into English until now. As it happens, it is currently being translated, so perhaps we'll see some kind of renewed interest in Romain Gary, but he has largely and unfortunately been forgotten in English.
Were there a lot of other readers? I mean, you know, there must have been a number of people who were planning to go off to college.
Absolutely. The Israeli army works in a way that's very different from the United States, from the U.S. military. Most of the soldiers in the better combat units of the Israeli army are middle-class kids who are, you know, bound for college after the army. So in the typical scheme of things, you finish high school, you do your military service for 3 years, you blow off steam in India or Nepal or South America, and then you come back to Israel and you go to college and you become a computer programmer or an accountant or an academic or something of that sort. And when I went off to find soldiers who'd been at the Pumpkin, I found all those things. I found a pretty solid slice of Israeli society, mainly of the middle class, because those are the kids who are at this fort.
The sense I get from reading Pumpkin Flowers is that not too many people really want to talk about those years. It's like they try to put them behind them at like this little PTSD universe.
It's very interesting. In Israel, everything is written about and talked about and argued about. It's an incredibly verbal country, and it's a country with a lot of writers. These years in Lebanon in the 1990s were forgotten almost as soon as the gate was locked on the night of the withdrawal in the spring of 2000. If you're looking for an academic history of those years, the years of the security zone in South Lebanon, you won't find one. None has been written. The period does not have a name. So I spent a lot of time explaining to people what I was talking about, what I meant when I said the war in Lebanon in the 90s, and I had to say the war in Lebanon in the 90s because it doesn't have a name, it doesn't have a military ribbon, there's no monument to it. It never officially happened, and the memories that it left were very intense personal memories, and there are many thousands of Israeli men like me who still carry memories from that time, but it left almost no collective memory at all.
Well, this is, of course, something you may not know, but is there any collective memory over on the Lebanese side?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to speak for the Lebanese, and they have written about this. They experienced a long and very traumatic period, beginning with the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, including the bombardment of Beirut, which is an event that really stands out in the Lebanese memory, understandably so, and it continues through the Israeli occupation of that strip of land in the south until 2000. I think it's wrapped up also in a more generally traumatic memory of the civil war in Lebanon, which began in 1975. Israel's invasion in 82 was linked to events in the Lebanese civil war, particularly the kind of power vacuum that was created along Israel's border and raids into Israel by Palestinian groups who were exploiting the power vacuum in Lebanon. And Israel became sucked into the Lebanese civil war. And I think that's all part of a kind of a very complicated and traumatic package of memory for the Lebanese. But I'm sure there are, you know, many people who could speak to that with much more knowledge and emotion than I could.
So what we're talking about is from the Israeli side, it's forgotten and it existed. From the Lebanese side, it's a small piece of a much bigger jigsaw puzzle.
That's right, and it's a jigsaw puzzle that's ongoing for the Lebanese.
Mati Friedman, your previous book, The Aleppo Codex, which is about a Bible that you had a search for, what prompted you to start your book writing career with this book, and how'd you hear about it?
The Aleppo Codex is one of the most important books on earth. You can make an argument for it being the most important book for Jews, and yet I had never heard of it. I grew up in a fairly knowledgeable Jewish home, and I knew nothing of the Aleppo Codex until I encountered it one day at Israel's National Museum in Jerusalem. It's kept in the same building as the Dead Sea Scrolls, which, of course, are very famous. In the basement is the Aleppo Codex. I was a reporter for the AP at the time. I was looking for ways not to cover the conflict, which is an endless and kind of circular story that isn't very interesting to cover for years and years on end. And I discovered that if I covered archaeology, that was a story with a lot of interest in the West, biblical archaeology. So I had my eyes open. I was looking for stories that might qualify. And when I found the Codex, I realized that this was an interesting story. And I wrote a kind of a regular news feature about it for the AP, about 1,200, 1,300 words that outlined the story of this manuscript. It was written more than 1,000 years ago in the Holy Land and ended up traveling to Cairo and then to Aleppo in Syria. It was kept in a safe in a synagogue in Aleppo for 600 years. And in 1947, it vanished when there were riots targeting the Jewish community in Aleppo, and it surfaced mysteriously in Jerusalem 10 years later, but 40% of it was missing, but 200 pages had evaporated. And that's the kind of story that journalists like. So I wrote a news feature about it, much of which I now know is wrong, because the common wisdom about the Codex at the time was wrong. And when I began looking into the story more and more deeply, and when I started calling people and knocking on some doors, initially no one wanted to talk to me. And that's when I understood that there was a bigger story here that needed to be investigated. And that was the origin of the book that became the Aleppo Codex.
You recently wrote an article about living in Jerusalem and how people kind of live together. There is a visit to a refugee camp, which is pretty frightening. I mean, one of the elements of the conflict, of course, is how the Palestinians are treated. And while you do point out that if they actually voted, they might be able to change that, but barring that, the refugees are treated pretty much as if they don't exist, and it's a lawless area.
The essay, which is called Jerusalem Spring 2015, What is Normal Here, is an attempt to look at life in Jerusalem as an actual city, not as a political issue or a kind of symbolic battle between good and evil, but as an actual city where people live. Jerusalem's a city about the size of Indianapolis, 800,000 people or so. There are parts of Jerusalem or life in Jerusalem that can be quite extreme, and people hear a lot about those aspects of life in our city. People, I think, hear less about the way life goes on in Jerusalem in a way that I think would be quite surprising to people who only get their picture of the city from media coverage. For example, in 2015, if we take all of the people who died violent deaths in Jerusalem, which is a city renowned globally for conflict and which probably has more international correspondents per capita than any other city on earth, maybe with the exception of Washington, D.C., if you take every single person who died in violent circumstances in the city last year, including victims of terror attacks, terrorists themselves, members of the security services, people who died in apolitical violence like domestic and criminal homicides, the number in Jerusalem is 37 in 2015. If you look at Indianapolis, the number is 144. So Jerusalem in some ways is a city of conflict, and in some ways it's it can be a stressful place to live. In many ways, it is a city that is more peaceful than most American cities, a city that holds together in ways that are quite unexpected. And those are facts that are known to those of us who live in Jerusalem, and I think are not known enough to people who look at Jerusalem from afar. And that's the point that I was trying to make in that essay.
Well, you also mentioned that there's a light rail that runs through all of the different neighborhoods. And while Jews might take one set of buses and Arabs another, everybody gets on the light rail. And now here we are a year later. Is there more mingling because there has to be?
Mingling because there has to be is actually a very good way to describe Jerusalem. The population of Jerusalem is about two-thirds Jewish and one-third Arab. The different populations of Jerusalem don't necessarily like each other, but the city is one economic unit. So almost half of the workers from East Jerusalem, from Palestinian East Jerusalem, work in the West. And if you know, something happened to prevent workers from East Jerusalem from reaching West Jerusalem, the entire city would shut down. There would be no transportation. There would be no tourist industry. There would be no hospitals because a large segment of the medical staff in Jerusalem, including the doctors, are Palestinian. So the city is described as being divided, and there's East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, but in fact the city is a much more complicated organism, which is not, I wouldn't call it integrated, but I would say that it is mixed in ways that are almost impossible to break apart.
I think in some respects American cities in different black or Latino and white areas might have similar, it might be somewhat similar, and I'm sure that there are probably Jews who are friends with Arabs and, you know.
I think that Jerusalem is a lot more like other cities than people usually like to think. It's usually described as a place that's, you know, that might as well be on the moon. But I think if you come at Jerusalem from a city like San Francisco or from a city like New York with, you know, different economic lines, different ethnic lines, very complicated kind of interplay between the different populations of the city, I think Jerusalem looks pretty familiar. And given the incredible pressures that are acting on this city because of its religious significance and because of its political significance and just because of its location a few hours away from Aleppo and Baghdad, given all those facts, I think Jerusalem functions remarkably well.
Mati Friedman, now you've written Pumpkin Flowers. You're working on another book?
I am, of course. You can't let the pen go dry. I'm working on a book about a spy, one of Israel's first spies.
You ever think about writing fiction?
You know, I find that in Israel it's just not necessary. The truth is more interesting.
You've been listening to an interview with Mati Friedman, whose book is titled Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story. His articles are on his website, which is matifriedman.com. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.